From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
A raid at State Senator Martin Sandoval's office down in Springfield was focused on evidence of kickbacks and documents involving several Department of Transportation employees. FBI agents searched Sandoval's home and offices last week. He is the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee.
Governor J.B. Pritzker, speaking today at a South Suburban Convention meeting, called for Senator Martin Sandoval to step down as chairman of the Transportation Committee.
While Senator Sandoval is under investigation, it's in the best interests of our state that he no longer serve as chairman of the Transportation Committee. If he doesn't step aside, he should be removed. We must assure the public that this work is on the up and up. Corruption and self-dealing will not be tolerated.
The governor says he has spoken to Senate President John Cullerton about Sandoval and his powerful position on the Transportation Committee, but it's unclear what steps Senate President Cullerton is going to take. The spokesman said this remains an active investigation, and the Senate president wants to, quote, make informed decisions.
Well, we know at least a bit more about what federal investigators were looking for when they conducted raids in a state senator's home and offices and some other locations as well. We'll talk more about that. Also, the Inspector General, the Legislative Inspector General, releasing reports this week that revolved around harassment complaints involving a couple of former aides to the House Speaker, Michael Madigan. We'll find out what was in those reports. That and more coming up on State Week in Springfield. I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He's the retired director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime reporter and State House observer. Brian Mackey's in our State House studio. He's Illinois Public Radio State House editor and joining us from Chicago today. We have Amanda Vinicky of WTTW and Chicago Tonight. It's always good to hear you, Amanda.
Oh, thanks, Sean.
Brian, I'm going to start with you, though. Let's talk about at least some of the information we've now learned regarding these raids that were conducted on the offices and home of Senator Martin Sandoval, and I mentioned some other locations as well. What do we know at this point?
Yeah, so what we learned, I mean, obviously we knew that the raids happened last week because we saw the FBI agents coming out of his office. But this week, a number of news organizations, including our own NPR Illinois, FOIA'd the Senate for records relating to these searches. Typically, when the government searches you, they hand you a copy of the warrant. They also leave a receipt for the property they take. And so the Senate responded to these requests. They redacted a lot of information, basically every proper name of anyone who wasn't Senator Sandoval in these documents. But through that, we are able to still glean hints about the scope of this investigation. And it looks like it's a pretty broad public corruption case. There are seven different federal statutes cited, including one on theft or bribery around federal funding. There's another one that talks about denial of honest services, which is a common catch-all that federal prosecutors use to go after politicians for denying their constituents honest services. And they also, in other types of corruption cases, too, I think that played a factor in the Enron case. We should say that neither Sandoval nor anyone else who is targeted in these investigations has been charged with a crime. But the agents were able to seize items relating to not only the senator, but a number of local officials, construction companies, IDOT officials, and that's what we know so far.
And Amanda, I mentioned that these raids occurred in other locations as well. In fact, one of the communities up in the Chicago area also releasing some of this same information. Did we learn anything from that?
I think we learned that, as Brian noted, the scope of this is large, but immense may be a better word for it, and one gets the sense that this certainly isn't the end of it. You can tell also from subpoenas that have been released from some of those communities that the feds most certainly have their eye on a Cook County commissioner, Jeff Tobolsky. He is also a mayor of the community of McCook. You know, it's one of those where you kind of go through and read these figures, and it's a who's who. There's an indication that a red light camera company may be involved, or at least people that have a role in that red light company that's called SafeSpeed. Again, that might go back to Martin Sandoval. There had been also somebody whose name may sound familiar, may ring a bell, Michael Vondra. He came up in some of those FBI wiretaps of former Governor Rod Blagojevich. He's, quote-unquote, the asphalt king, and we also know that there were raids on at least one of his businesses. Certainly, he is a campaign contributor to Senator Sandoval. There are a whole lot of connections, and like I said, this comes after, of course, you have already had the FBI very publicly zoning in on Chicago Alderman Ed Burke, on some of those who has been indicted. And then other raids of those who are close with House Speaker Michael Madigan, subpoena of ComEd. So not saying that these and those are related, merely pointing out that the feds have their hands full, and they've always said they're taking corruption seriously, but they are most definitely upping the ante.
And Brian, not everybody knows who Martin Sandoval is, but he's become a pretty powerful lawmaker. Give us a little bit of background about him and his role in the legislature.
Yeah, he's been in the legislature for almost 2 decades now. He was elected with the help of the Hispanic Democratic Organization, which is a former political group that kind of imploded in patronage scandals about a decade ago. But he came to Springfield. He's been a state senator his whole time, and he's in recent years has amassed power as the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee. And he was one of the leading lawmakers. He held hearings all over Illinois earlier this year on the need for a capital plan and a big statewide construction program. And at these hearings, he would often sort of browbeat local officials, saying, you know, you all tell me, you come and say how you need potholes filled, you need your bridges repaired, but where are you pushing for higher taxes to pay for these things? And so ultimately, the Illinois legislature did pass a massive building plan. He was one of the lead people behind that. And that's why your gas tax doubled over the summer, and that's why there's going to be this expansion of casino gambling across the state, among other things, to pay for this construction program. But it is a pretty powerful position, and that's why you have a lot of people saying, and you know, if I guess I don't even know if there are allegations yet, right? But if it turns out that the feds are investigating, we have construction companies, we have the chairman of the Transportation Committee, we have villages that are known to have a lot of construction company activity in them. There's quarries in this district that are, you know, where the materials are used to make roads. If these things do ultimately tie together, people are wondering, why is Senator Sandoval maintaining his position as chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee? And we heard the governor at the top of the show calling on him to step down or be removed. And the Senate president, John Cullerton, has been not willing, at least as we go to air midday Friday, has not been willing to remove him from either the Senate Transportation Committee or his position in the leadership in the Senate Democratic Caucus.
And Charlie, you're...
And by the way, Sean, let me point out real quickly as well that the redactions of the FOIA subpoena that we got of Sandoval, that was also done by Cullerton's office. The Senate president said it was done in concert with the feds, or at least asking for their advice as to what could be made public and not, as well as with an opinion from the attorney general. But we have, of course, had subpoenas released without all of those redactions. So that is where this most certainly looks as if the Senate president is protecting Sandoval. He says that it's because he wants to make an informed decision, and because there, at this point, of course, hasn't been any clear accusation of criminal wrongdoing, no indictment, no charges brought, but it is very apparent that the feds believe Senator Sandoval is up to something. We don't have any comment from Sandoval himself. He has, thus far, that I know of anyway, not responded to any of the, I'm sure, multitude of media requests for comment and response.
And I did want to point out, too, our member station WBEZ in Chicago filing suit to get more information of what was blacked out in that document. But, Charlie, I want to get your thoughts, especially when it comes to, you know, Governor Pritzker making his statements and the Senate President, John Cullerton. I wouldn't say standing by Sandoval at this point, but he certainly hasn't taken the action some people might have thought he would.
Well, if I were an advisor to either of those individuals, I would suggest that for the sake of the overall building program, it might be prudent for Senator Sandoval to at least temporarily move away from the chairmanship of that committee. There's been a lot of negative publicity around the Public Works program. Some of the items that are in there that are really small ticket items in terms of a $45 billion program are being accused of being pork, trying to disparage the whole thing. People are attacking the fact that, well, we have to pay more money. I don't know where they figure we're going to get bridges repaired and potholes fixed and the kind of improvements that we need in state facilities if nobody wants to pay for it. I mean, the stuff doesn't grow on trees. And so just for the overall sake of the program, of the Public Works program, I think it would be prudent for Senator Sandoval to step aside so that there are no repercussions, if you will, from the suspicions that are being raised and that the feds seem to be acting on with respect to his role in terms of the value of the program itself. Because as anybody who listens to the show knows, I'm a very big believer in taking care of the state's infrastructure, because that's one of the things that is vital to our economic success.
Well, we'll continue to follow that case. But also, let's move on to some other news that took place this week. The Legislative Inspector General, Amanda, reported on some what I would call high-profile sexual harassment cases that really had stemmed from people who had worked under Michael Madigan, the Illinois House Speaker and State Democratic Party Chairman. So fill us in on what was in these reports. Did we learn anything from those?
You know, I would say I'm not sure what we necessarily learned, because some of this had really been out there. Both of these situations were brought about by whistleblowers who had previously gone public. One, Elena Hampton, against Kevin Quinn. She accused him of sexual harassment. Quinn is the brother of Chicago Alderman Marty Quinn of the 13th Ward. Of course, that is where Madigan, they share an office together. They are kind of in cahoots politically. And Kevin Quinn had both worked for the state under Madigan as well as Madigan's political arm. And Elena Hampton came forward with a series of texts that he just would not leave her alone despite her asking him to, even though he was her advisor. And so what we got the takeaway from the Inspector General at long last is that he would have been in breach of the state's sexual harassment prohibitions had he not resigned from his job or had they been in place at the time. Rather, however, those very prohibitions were brought about because Hampton had gone public. The other is going to be a name that is far more familiar to the other case that is going to be far more familiar to Springfield residents, and that is Tim Mapes, who had been the long time very loyal, very organized, a personality himself, chief of staff to Madigan. And Mapes, again, a whistleblower in the name of Sherry Garrett, accused him of harassment as well. There was an accusation. He made a comment about her pink bra, and so in that regard, sexual in nature, but largely it was seen more as a sort of bullying as the boss. And again, the Inspector General found that, like Quinn, Mapes should not be permitted to, again, be hired by the state, that they should have files in the, you know, there should be paperwork within their state files that talks about all of this. Mapes had tried to protest this. His attorneys fought back vociferously, saying that he didn't have any obligation to cooperate with the Inspector General, given that he had left behind the state, that he had retired, was basically, you know, pushed out by Madigan despite all of those years of loyalty. And Mapes saying that there was not concrete evidence in his view, despite what the Inspector General had found, that he had engaged in any fashion in sexual harassment. So they're certainly worth a read in terms of giving a scope of what workers deal with, the sort of mindset, and really, frankly, where the Inspector General's office is at in terms of ability to carry out any sort of punishment for wrongdoing when it is found.
Yeah, Brian, weigh in on that as well. The Inspector General, the teeth that, you know, is in the law when it comes to these types of investigations.
Yeah, when somebody quits, what sort of sanction do you really have? It's not as though the Inspector General can bring a criminal case for violating the Ethics Act. Although we should point out, and I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but the Inspector General, at least in the case of Kevin Quinn, did refer the case to the Attorney General's office. There was a possibility of like a cyber stalking charge for these text messages repeatedly asking her out, even though she had told him to stop. And the Attorney General's office declined to bring any sort of criminal case. But the Ethics Act...
Brian, real quickly, here, the Attorney General's office did say that they had found that there was insufficient evidence, that's a quote from the Attorney General Kwame Rule spokesperson, there was insufficient evidence to support criminal charges under the cyberstalking statute or also under another statute that prohibits harassment through electronic communications, pointing back to a court case, an Illinois Supreme Court case from 2017 that narrowed the scope of what criminal charges could be brought for cyberstalking. So just pointing that out there, because there are those who say that, again, Democrats are in charge, of course, of the legislature, the governor's office, the attorney general's office. Both of the accused in the cases that we were talking about are prominent Democrats or one-time prominent Democrats with close allegiance to House Speaker Michael Madigan, obviously the chairman of the Democratic Party. So there are certainly those who raise their eyebrows and believe that there's still sort of a protection racket going on. That is what the attorney general's office has said in response to why it did not bring charges. Back to you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate. I'm glad you mentioned that clarification. And I mean, I guess you do the attorney general's office distinguishing between the sort of harassment case where, you know, people are showing up in the middle of the night, banging on your window or something. And not to minimize what Quinn did, Hampton says it definitely created a hostile work environment. She had anxiety every time her phone dinged with a text message from him. And, you know, she's pursuing a lawsuit over this. To getting back to the Ethics Act, the legislative inspector general asserts, Carol Pope asserts, that she does continue to have jurisdiction even after somebody leaves state employment, citing a statute that says she has jurisdiction over current and former state employees regarding events occurring during any period of employment. Mapes objected to that vociferously. That was among his many objections that Amanda pointed out. And we should add that the speaker, trying to stay on the right side of history and what seems to be the right thing to do here, did say that he believes that these employees should have cooperated with the investigation.
And Charlie, I think when it comes to these cases and really anything else that's come up recently, the thing that pops into my mind is Michael Madigan, I think, has been wounded by this as far as his, you know, that's how some people view Michael Madigan. But he's still there. And it seems as though I think some people thought this might be, you know, the end for Michael Madigan because of these incidents. But he still continues on. Has he weathered this storm?
Well, at least until this point, he has, as you noted. And he acted fairly quickly in this. You know, we talked about how the Inspector General found that what Quinn and Mapes did was in violation of the Ethics Act as it stands now. But at the time it occurred, that Ethics Act wasn't there. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons, one of the impetus behind the new Ethics Act, the revised, stronger one on sexual harassment, was in fact the behavior of Mapes and Quinn. That was among the instances that caused the speaker and the legislature in general to kind of crack down on this kind of behavior that you know, 40, 50 years ago was seen as this is just sort of run-of-the-mill stuff that happens in the workplace. Now we've become, I think, more sensitive to the impact this has on employees when they have a boss who's overbearing, either as just a flat-out bully or as somebody who's harassing them in a sexual nature. So I think we're making progress, and I would say to Madigan's credit, he acted really quickly. He did not try and defend Mapes. He did not try and defend Quinn to the bitter end. He let him go. He cut ties with Mapes really fairly soon. So I think so far at least he's weathered it and he's kind of come out ahead.
I do have to wonder, though. I mean, the House Democrats had a reputation for, I guess the polite way to put it would be, or the positive spin would be, they were a very hard-charging organization to work for, and they demanded a lot of their people. And it seems like it would be surprising to me if he had no idea how hard-charging and, you know, allegedly, or according to this report, bullying his right-hand man could be for decades as the chief of staff. It just doesn't seem like it was much of a secret around the Capitol. I will also say that how the speaker responded to this is one of the disputed points in the lawsuit, and we see a little bit of that in this report. He claims that he wanted to fire Quinn earlier in the process. Ultimately, they ended up doing so a day before Elena Hampton went public with her complaints. It came out that they fired him, and then the Tribune had already conducted an interview with her and ended up, I think, kind of rushing that out there. And he says he wanted to do it earlier, and his lawyer apparently told the legislative inspector general that they thought they were being sensitive to Hampton because she didn't want a big deal made of it. And if he had fired this person, it would have kind of blown up more. That's something that Hampton disputes. She thinks there was more of a whitewash going on and does not feel like her concerns were being taken seriously enough. And for what the truth is there, if we ever really know it, we'll have to wait and see how the federal case works out.
Yeah, I agree with the comment that Madigan's organization is hard charging, and they want results, and they're, I guess I would say, pretty tough taskmasters from all I've seen over the years. But in a sense, it's like a professional sports organization where you have coaches who really come down hard on the athletes to make them perform. The people who work for the Democratic Party aren't paid the same kind of salaries that folks in the NFL are. But I think it's that same attitude, and the harassment, the sexual harassment, is something that I would say Madigan would find a lot more offensive than the fact that you have a boss who's a strict taskmaster.
And Amanda, let me real quick before we run out of time, just a couple of minutes here, but I wanted to ask you, you talk to a lot of people who work in state government, not just for Michael Madigan. Has the situation changed? Has the workplace changed? Are new rules being put into place in most of these locations? And do people feel as though that the mood is different?
I mean, I think the mood has to be different. There's just a different tenor everywhere, not just in state government, with, you know, the fallout of Me Too from Hollywood to state capitals. But there is nonetheless, I think, a mentality. It's a top-down sort of culture. If you do speak with Hampton, she feels, you know, persecuted, and it is as if she is in a worse spot after having gone public with this and ostracized by a group that she believes she was once part of. There certainly, Madigan is weaker. He has not. For a while, during a stretch of Governor Rauner, when he really, in a sense, perhaps had to, he was having regular media availabilities. Madigan, by and large, has ducked from the press, has not given many, if really any, interviews in terms of this. He talks about when we get press releases, they're kind of upping the ante there in terms of sending out accomplishments, taking seriously things like, you know, sex trafficking, which is different than the sort of press release you would have gotten from Madigan himself previously. But he recognizes that things are different. I don't know that it's as if the Capitol culture has been turned upside down in any way, however.
Okay, Brian, just a few seconds left here, but I did want to touch on something else that took place this week. Planned Parenthood making the news. Give us an update on what's going on, and this is in Southern Illinois.
Yeah, it's, I guess you can call it Southern Illinois. It's just in the what we call the Metro East area. For people who are not familiar, that's the large chunk of the St. Louis metropolitan area that is on the eastern or Illinois side of the Mississippi River. These are basically suburbs of St. Louis. And Planned Parenthood has announced an 18,000-square-foot clinic there. This comes at a time as Missouri has really been among the states that have been tightening restrictions on abortion this year. There's a clinic, the last clinic in Missouri, the last abortion clinic, is in St. Louis, and it is fighting to keep its license. But Planned Parenthood built this facility, and it's interesting how they did so. They did it mostly, or pretty much exclusively, in secret. They used a shell company to hire the contractors. Apparently, the people who were working there had no idea what sort of facility they were working on, and they say they did that because in past instances, once companies realized that it was going to be a clinic that where abortion services were provided, they couldn't get their telephone or data lines installed. This is according to a CBS News. They got a sort of a special tour last month and had a big report on this. And you had people protesting suppliers at other facilities they've tried to build in the past. So this is going to make Illinois more of a sort of a destination or haven, as the Democrats, or most Democrats would say, for having access to reproductive health services. So I guess it sort of is what the people who support these abortion access would like, and it's what the people who dislike the idea of broader abortion rights feared would happen.
Okay, let's go to our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's go ahead and start with you.
Okay, well, there was relatively good news on the economic front. The Flash Index, which is a shot in time that kind of measures Illinois' economic condition, it went to 105.5, up from 105.1 in August. That was in September. And University of Illinois economist J. Fred Geertz, Professor Geertz, who compiles the index, said that despite numerous reports of slowing U.S. and global economies, Illinois appears to be doing well. He cautioned, however, a large one-month change can be the result of unusual variations in tax receipts patterns rather than true economic impacts, but kind of supporting the notion that Illinois is weathering whatever economic storm might be out there. The Commission on Government and Forecasting and Accountability released its report on what's going on in fiscal 2020 through September, through 4 months of the new fiscal year, and it said that revenues to the state's general funds, our main checkbook, have increased by more than $1.2 billion.
Brian?
As I was leaving the state capitol late one evening this week, fortunately you don't have to work too many late nights in state government at this time of year, but as I was leaving, I looked up behind me and noticed that the dome was lit up. And this is the first time that I'd seen it that way in literally years. The Secretary of State's office had turned the lights off on the Capitol dome during the budget impasse, apparently as a money-saving tactic, and now they have turn them back on. They're using energy-efficient lighting, LED bulbs. Apparently, it's only going to cost about $4 a day. It really does look beautiful. It's a nice nice sight, hopefully a sign of better days ahead for Illinois state government.
All right, that will do it for our broadcast this week. Members of the panel included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and our guest, Amanda Vinicky. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us on NPR One. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.